Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 29th of November, these are our main stories. There are reports of heavy gunfire in the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank as the Israeli army conducts an operation in the main refugee camp there. A study by the European Union finds out who faces most online hate and abuse. The party of the former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan says he stepped down as chairman to focus on his legal woes. Also in this podcast, after Australia's Prime Minister apologises for the thalidomide scandal, we hear how the drug continues to affect survivors.
It impacts every single minute of every single day of my life. To do simplest thing like brush my teeth, I stand on my left leg and raise my right leg and put it up onto the basin.
While the fragile truce between Israel and Hamas, now into its sixth day, appears to be holding in Gaza, violence appears to be escalating in the other Palestinian territory, the occupied West Bank. Officials there say two children have been killed in the city of Jenin as Israeli troops continue their military operation in the main refugee camp there. Soldiers are reported to have surrounded a house and fired on the residents. Two people were detained. One of them is said to be a member of an armed group called the Jenin Battalion. Hospitals are also reported to have been under siege. A senior official from the ruling Fatah party in the West Bank, Sabri Saddam, told my colleague Lucy Hawkins about the impact the Israeli operation was having there.
The situation is extremely dire. The expansion of operation is in clear defiance of the truce that exists and the agreement of ceasing fire for the time being. And one does not understand as to why such operation takes such magnitude at such critical time. To my knowledge, there's three hospitals that have been blocked and been sealed out. So people can't even move the injured into the vicinity of the hospital since the Israeli vehicles are blocking the way there.
How is the Palestinian Authority responding to these allegations of armed Palestinian groups operating in some of these civilian areas as well, which is obviously heightening tensions, putting people at risk?
You cannot say that the Palestinians have invoked anything for the last week or so. And in the course of the last few weeks since the 7th of October, it's been Israel that's been initiating attacks against the Palestinians. There's no way that you can talk about truce in Gaza and provoke people in the West Bank. If anything, Israel is interested in heating up the front in the West Bank so that it finishes with Gaza, turns its attention to the West Bank, and conduct a wider military operation with different scales. Plus, the settlers' violence is increasing, and that's causing major concern as well amongst Palestinians. And there's been posters around that have been circulated in the streets of the West Bank by settlers calling upon Palestinians to leave the West Bank. So this is a major displacement project that Israel is advocating.
Sabri Saddam, Deputy Secretary General of Fatah Central Committee. Well, our correspondent in Jerusalem, Wira Davis, told us what more was known about the Israeli military operation in Jenin.
Yeah, it appears that there's an Israeli military operation against what it regards as terrorists, Palestinian militants inside Jenin. The news coming out of there is unclear at points, but several medical workers and ambulances on the ground have said they've found it difficult to take the wounded to hospital at some points because they say they were denied in doing so by Israeli soldiers. So we know there have been at least a couple of fatalities in Jenin, but these are continuing Israeli military operations against Palestinian militants. And these kind of things have been going on ever since October the 7th, with rising anger in the occupied Palestinian West Bank at what is happening in and around Gaza. And of course, it shouldn't be forgot, dozens of Palestinians have been killed in these clashes and in shootings by Israeli soldiers since the start of hostilities in Gaza. So, of course, much of the world's attention is focused on Gaza, but there are increasing tensions as well in cities like Jenin in the Palestinian West Bank.
And meanwhile, the humanitarian situation in Gaza is getting ever more dire. And we've heard from aid agencies that have been able to get to northern Gaza, to Gaza City, saying parts of Gaza City are uninhabitable as winter is closing in.
Yeah, anybody who's seen the pictures from Gaza might appreciate the level of destruction. In some parts of northern Gaza, about 50%, if not more, of the buildings have been destroyed. But again, what one plus side of this continued truce is that it's allowed aid agencies to get into Gaza, to get in on the ground and to assess the damage, not just to buildings, but to infrastructure, to water desalination plants, to the sewerage system. And, of course, more aid has been getting in through the Egyptian border, around, if not more than 100 trucks a day now bringing in some fuel, food and medical supplies. So that's another reason why the aid agencies would also welcome an extension of this truce. You know, the World Health Organization has repeated many dire warnings now about the worsening health crisis, particularly in those densely populated areas, the camps that have sprung up in southern Gaza. Those people who left their homes in the north are now congregated and concentrated in very tight areas with very poor sanitation. And the WHO, the World Health Organization, is desperately worried about the worsening health and medical crisis in those refugee areas in the south.
Wira Davis in Jerusalem. Abusive comments, harassment and incitement to violence are often in the headlines. Now a new report from the European Union has looked into who is most targeted and why these hateful messages manage to slip through online platforms' content moderation tools. The author is David Reichel, project manager at the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights. He told my colleague James Cocknell more about his research into online hate.
For this report, we collected data on online hate targeted at women and selected ethnic minorities through a dedicated keyword search, and covered four platforms in four EU member states. And out of over 340,000 posts that we collected, we selected some 1,600 for further analysis. And there, what we found was quite widespread online hate. So it was more than half of the posts were considered as hateful by human coders. And that includes a variety of forms of online hate, including mostly offensive speech. But we also found elements of incitement to violence, to discrimination and hatred in 16% of the cases. And also denigration, meaning people were compared to objects or animals, and a lot of negative stereotyping. The main finding was, in a way, was that hate targeted at women was found to be most prevalent across all the platforms we covered. And that most often included denigrating language. But women also face higher levels of incitement to violence than the other groups. However, targeted at ethnic minorities, they most often contain negative stereotyping. And what is more important, that in almost half of the hateful posts we found, direct harassment was included. And that means that specific individuals were targeted with the messages. And that, again, was especially high for women, with 2/3 of the hateful posts found to be targeting specific persons.
These are very, very shocking findings, but I'm tempted to say not surprising for people who do log on, or perhaps people who suffer the sorts of abuse. Why, though, are these messages allowed to proliferate on social media platforms?
This research underlines how difficult it is to tackle online hate speech. And that's for several reasons. I mean, first, there's often no clear understanding of online hate. So the coders we used, they reached a relatively high level of agreement in their categorizations, but they still faced some uncertainty in 1 out of 5 posts they tried to assess. In addition, there was a disagreement also, so to some extent, between the coders and legal experts we employed about whether certain posts fall under the definition of incitement to violence, for example. And this is a challenge because current content moderation practices, they have to react quickly and often make assessments without being able to consider all the factors surrounding certain expressions. And that's also a reason why often hate still slips through.
So challenges then for those who want to stop hate. But it's clear, isn't it, that this hatred is so widespread that it's having a really damaging effect on societies everywhere, really.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that hampers how people engage online in a way. And I found it particularly concerning how easy it is to find online hate, and especially the way people address women online. Although with our methodology, of course, we also missed a certain speech because we only used specific keywords, and online hate also happens in other more subtle ways. Yet still, the often sexualized, violent language targeted at women is for sure a major concern.
David Reichel, project manager at the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights. The UN's latest climate conference gets underway on Thursday, and many will be looking at China's rapidly growing number of coal power stations in dismay. But the country has also been rolling out vast new green energy projects, outstripping government targets. And Beijing is positioning itself to dominate the global supply of clean energy products like electric vehicles. However, as our China correspondent Stephen McDonnell reports, there's still a looming battle with the country's powerful coal sector.
Standing in the street in Beijing, you can see the extent of the take-up of electric cars easily. There's one, two more close behind. You don't have to be a car expert to spot them. They have special green number plates. And there are 18 million already on the road. This year, nearly one in three passenger vehicles sold in China is said to have been electric. 44-year-old Zheng Zhe, who works in real estate, has owned several.
Many in my family have replaced their petrol cars with electric vehicles, and they're not going back.
As we drive around suburban Beijing, he explains that government tax breaks kept prices down at the beginning, and that other incentives have helped make the industry viable. Ask him about the problem of having to charge the battery.
In the past 2 years, the speed of building charging stations has been very fast. There are now more of them than petrol stations.
A 3.5-hour flight away in the south of the country, a huge auto show in Guangzhou gives you an idea of the money pouring into the electric vehicle industry. Half of the entire exhibition is made up of electric cars, many of them new brands that most will not have heard of. Certainly the salespeople on the floor of this cavernous space are talking up the bright future for China's EVs, which they expect to dominate globally in the years to come.
We can cut manufacturing costs and also make sure our EVs are good quality.
And the electricity driving China's electric cars is coming increasingly from non-fossil fuel sources, including hydro, solar and wind, which today deliver nearly half of the country's power. It's highly visible in the provinces to the north of Beijing, where the wind howls down off the Mongolian plateau. I'm standing on the hill looking down over Quantin Lake, and all around it there are wind turbines. And passing through are coal trains. And you can just hear by the constant sound how long the trains are. Here you have China's energy mix in a nutshell, the old and the new. The coal trains passing through fields filled with wind turbines. This challenge from renewable energy is expected to attract a level of pushback from fossil fuel companies. The recent boost in renewable energies in China has been phenomenal. For 12 years in a row, it's had more installed wind power than anywhere else. The country makes up 40% of all solar power produced in the world. According to the Carbon Brief website, China's overall carbon emissions could peak, then start falling years earlier than expected. Laurie Muhlenberger was the report's author.
If China keeps up the current rate of additions of clean energy, emissions should fall next year, which would be well ahead of the schedule of peaking emissions before 2030.
There could be a fight looming. For years, China had been gradually moving away from fossil fuel output, but has reversed this, and new approvals for coal-fired power stations have skyrocketed.
There is a risk that when all of these new coal-fired power plants get added, you have powerful state-owned enterprises that have made the investments, that have an interest in making use of those investments, so they will push back. However, the clean energy industry has grown much, much bigger and more powerful, and there are no pushover anymore.
So we could be set for a showdown over whose electricity gets used to meet China's ever-expanding needs, with implications for the entire planet.
That report by Stephen McDonnell. More than 60 years after the thalidomide scandal first erupted, the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has issued a national apology to those affected by the scandal. The drug, touted as a treatment for morning sickness, was given to pregnant women around the world in the 1950s and early 60s. But it was then taken off the market after scientists found it had led to thousands of babies being born with severe disabilities, usually in the form of shortened, malformed limbs. Mr. Albanese called it one of the darkest chapters in Australia's medical history.
We are sorry for the harm and the hurt and the hardship you have endured. We are sorry for all the cruelty you have had to bear. We are sorry for all the opportunities you have been denied. We are sorry for the battle you have had to fight.
A financial assistance program for survivors was only set up a few years ago and then closed to new applicants. But Australia says it will now reopen it for survivors like Trish Jackson. She described how thalidomide had affected her to my colleague, James Copnell.
I can use my little left hand. It can do a few things. My right little arm doesn't do anything. And I'm also right-footed, so left-handed and right-footed. It impacts every single minute of every single day of my life. You know, doing everyday things, you know, I have to contort my body in very weird ways to do simplest thing like brush my teeth. I stand on my left leg and raise my right leg and put it up onto the basin. And because I've done that all my life, you know, our bodies are just falling apart at a very rapid rate.
You write and even paint with the paintbrush or the pen between your toes.
That's correct, yes. I don't remember learning to write, but Mum always said that I used my feet from day one. So it's amazing how the body compensates for missing limbs. The painting came about 7 years ago. I've been painting, and it was because I was in a very dark space with body pain, and I knew that I had to do something to get out of that dark space. And so I started to take up painting, and it's just grown and grown and grown. And now I am a student of the mouth and foot painters, which is absolutely awesome.
What does this apology mean to you?
The apology is recognition that the government failed to protect the Australian citizens and that they're finally, after 60 years, going to put things right for us, help with our medical costs and just day-to-day living expenses for extraordinary costs that, you know, associated with our disability.
And are those costs quite considerable? Will it make a big difference, this sort of help from the government?
Yes, absolutely. It will make a big difference to our lives. The only thing is that the system that they've set up is really hard for us to access and very time-consuming and very physically demanding to fill in all those forms. So while the apology is awesome, they need to, you know, act as well to fix the health fund for us, make it easier.
Thalidomide survivor Trish Jackson. Still to come.
All the evidence we have in the archaeological record that men were hunting is the exact same evidence we have for women. So if you're not convinced by the archaeological evidence, then you're not convinced anyone was hunting.
Challenging the myth that prehistoric women stayed at home while their men hunted. The BBC has been told that Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan is to step down as chairman of the PTI party. The former cricketing legend was ousted as Prime Minister last year and has been in prison on multiple charges since early August. He's also been disqualified from standing in the general election. A lawyer for the PTI says Mr. Khan chose to resign because of legal hurdles. Our correspondent in Islamabad, Carrie Davies, told us the former Prime Minister's woes began some months ago.
It's been quite a tumultuous year for Imran Khan. Of course, it was in April 2022 that he was ousted from his position as Prime Minister in a vote of no confidence. Many analysts saw him coming to power originally in Pakistan because of the support he had from the powerful political military here in Pakistan, often referred to as the establishment. And then as a result of falling out and that disintegration of that relationship, that played a part in him also losing that position of power too. But instead of going quietly, Imran Khan continued to be quite vocal and quite critical of the leadership of the military. Then this year, in May, we saw him being arrested for the first time. That led to protests around the country, some of which turned violent, and some military buildings were attacked. Imran Khan was ultimately let out of prison within a few days in that situation, but there was a massive crackdown on his party. Many of his senior leadership were arrested and then subsequently resigned from the party altogether. Other members of the leadership are in prison, as Mr. Khan is, and others are in hiding. Mr. Khan himself was arrested again at the beginning of August, and that was the last time he was seen in public. He has been in prison since then, originally given bail on the case that he was originally in prison for, but he's now awaiting trial for multiple other cases that are built up against him. So that's part of the backdrop. The other part of this story, of course, is that Pakistan is due to hold elections. They are now scheduled to happen on the 8th of February next year. As you mentioned, Imran Khan has been disqualified from running. And the big problem comes if he stays in the position of party chairman while being disqualified, the impact that would have on the party. The party itself has been told to choose a new chairman within the course of a few days or risk losing its very important emblem on the ballot paper, which is of a cricket bat, which many people will be able to recognise. That's really important for the party. And that was a big concern. So we heard from his lawyer this morning, saying that Imran Khan has decided to step down from that position, from the role of chairman. Now, there's been back and forth with some people in the party over the course of the last few hours, some saying that this is not Imran Khan leaving the party. Of course, he will play a key role. But the big question, of course, is if Imran Khan has now stepped down from this role, what will that mean for the party that he founded in the elections in the beginning of next year?
And briefly, Carrie, who do you think would replace him?
That is the big question. And the suggestion is that Imran Khan, if he's made this decision, will start to suggest who he wants to put in his place. Lots of different names have been bandied around, but some of the rumours are talking about a lawyer from his own party that would step into that role. The big problem that Imran Khan has, of course, with his party is that he is ultimately the party. There aren't that many individuals that are still left in the party that are particularly prominent or well known. And if he is out of sight, if he is out of the campaign, that will pose an issue for the party as they are starting to campaign for the general election.
Kerry Davies in Islamabad. The myth that in prehistoric times men were hunters while women were gatherers has been challenged in recent years, but it persists. Well, two new studies published in the American Anthropologist Journal may help to shift the balance. Victoria Uwankunda spoke to the two authors of the reports, Dr. Sarah Lacey from the University of Delaware and Dr. Kara Okobok from the University of Notre Dame. First, Dr. Lacey.
All the evidence we have in the archaeological record that men were hunting is the exact same evidence we have for women. So if you're not convinced by the archaeological evidence, then you're not convinced anyone was hunting.
It goes to show how hard it is to overturn really deep-seated ideas that have been around for a long time, not just in, you know, the halls of academia, but also in popular culture. We see these images of man the hunter and woman the gatherer, you know, in cartoons and in movies and in books and TV shows, everything. You know, he who writes history is the one who gets to drive the narrative. And it was he who wrote this history, not she, or even any sort of thought of what she might be involved in our evolutionary trajectory.
And so if the women were hunting, were the men just sitting pretty at home?
I wish, but we're actually arguing that, you know, there's no gendered labor roles. So both men and women are hunting. Everyone's doing the same thing, and at least that's what it looks like when we look at the archaeological evidence, the anatomical evidence, and the fossils. Everyone's doing the same behavior. So men are processing hides, and women are doing ambush hunting.
What would they be hunting? Would they be hunting the same size of animals?
So when we're looking in like the Middle Paleolithic, which is what we associate with Neanderthals, what they're hunting is kind of what's bioavailable. So we often think of woolly mammoths, but that's, you know, we have a bit of a bias towards sites that are further north. So they're going to be hunting basically the same thing if we're assuming that they're getting the same kind of trauma patterns on their body. Once we get more into the Upper Paleolithic, which are our own species, they are innovating more of these kinds of hunting tools that have less wear and tear on the body. Bow and arrows, fishing hooks, hunting nets. And so it's possible that women were then focusing more on smaller game, but there's no explicit evidence for who's using those tools. So that's totally conjectural.
Yeah, I would just also like to add, when it came to the big game, it wasn't just one individual hunting, you know, a woolly rhinoceros or a woolly mammoth. It took the whole group of people to take that animal down.
How have people been responding to your findings in this new study?
So it ranges from, you know, people having really wonderful responses and well as responses of such as, of course everyone was doing everything because you had to in small groups, to the people who have said really horrible sexist things in different forms of harassment.
Things about like, well, what about child rearing and what were the men just sitting at home, or women can't run as fast as men and aren't as strategically thinking as men, therefore they would not have been as good of hunters.
Dr. Sarah Lacey and Dr. Kara Okotbok. Eavesdrop on any conversation between football fans and you can be almost certain it will turn to VAR, the technology which is intended to help referees decide on penalties and offsides. Some say it's ruining the game, with the delays disrupting the flow of matches. But now footballing authorities are talking of further expanding VAR to cover throw-ins. And it's not the only rule change in the offing. There are plans to introduce 10-minute sin bins for cynical fouls and dissent. My colleague Nick Robinson has been talking to Jenny Frampton, a former professional referee in men's football and vice president of the International Federation of Sports Officials. He began by asking her about the sin bin proposal.
I think sin bins is probably a really good idea, particularly at the higher levels of the game. They trialled them at grassroots, and yes, they were successful as a deterrent. But I think at the higher levels, when you're going to get a player off the field for up to 10 minutes, that might change behaviours.
So that's what it's for. It's saying you're mouthing off to the referee, off you go and calm down.
Yes, and if we can use the sin bin as a deterrent for poor behaviour, so they just calm down, you know, just let the steam, the hot air sort of settle, then I think that's a really good idea.
Now, I have to say that I rarely am lost for words when I hear a bit of news, but when I was heard that VAR might be extended, I couldn't believe it. Tell me this. Do referees think this is working?
Well, I think this is now becoming ridiculous. The big issue with behaviour on the field now is mainly because of VAR decisions that are given or not given. So, like most things, you need to really drill down to the root of the issue, and that is, let's get VAR right. So clubs and managers and players kept saying they want the big decisions to be correct. Well, this is what you've got. You've got 4 and 5 minute stoppages for VAR to make a decision before you can celebrate a goal or not.
Isn't the problem that you've taken a subjective decision and you've just made it subjective with more people involved, taking longer, and in the end, you look at the replay and say, well, you could call it this way, you could call it that way, but you've just ruined the atmosphere at any football match.
Totally ruined it. It's sanitising it. It's taking the passion out of the game. I think VAR has a really positive place in the game, but take it back to what it was brought in for. It was to help referees make the decisions on the clear and obvious that they have missed. Now, if we start to sanitize it with throw-ins and goal kicks and corner kicks, you just as well not have a referee on the field. Just rely upon VAR completely. I believe VAR can be a useful tool, but now they're using it as a weapon, and that is spoiling our game.
But couldn't they just limit it in the way, say, in tennis it is, for things that are objective? It either crossed the line or it didn't cross the line, like you do with goal mouth. And not for those subjectives, was that really handball?
Yeah, and I think this is the problem. Why would assistant referees or referees make decisions? Why would they, when they know VAR are going to make them? I've come to the conclusion, I don't have an idea anymore what a penalty is and what it isn't. That's
you don't.
I've come to the conclusion.
You spent your life refereeing.
I know. And I clearly don't.
Former football referee Janie Frampton. In many parliaments, members are expected to adhere to certain standards. A case in point being the US Senate, which recently passed a resolution formalising business attire as a proper dress code after a Democratic member, John Fetterman, turned up for work in shorts and a hoodie. Well, in Kenya, the Speaker of Parliament, Moses Wetangula, has ruled that the Kaunda suit, named after the former president of Zambia, is not acceptable attire. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, explains why.
Well, first of all, let's focus on the Cowander suit and what it looks like. So close your eyes and jump in the wardrobe. Or maybe for health and safety reasons, you'd better jump in the wardrobe first and then close your eyes. Now imagine a jacket, short-sleeved with lapels. Or even one that's got a short, upturned Nehru-style collar. Well, the problem for Kenyan MPs is these suits are worn without a shirt and tie. And as the Speaker Moses Wetangula pointed out, rule number 9 of Kenya's parliamentary dress code says, when in the chamber, male MPs have to wear a tie, as well as a shirt and jacket, of course. It's not the first time the rule book has been brought out. 20 years ago, the opposition politician Raila Odinga walked in wearing a flowing Nigerian robe known as an agbada. He had to learn that unlike primary school children across the world, who are treated to an occasional wear what you like day, Kenyan MPs have to stick to the jacket and tie uniform every day. Decades ago, it looked as though Tanzania's independence leader Julius Nyerere and, of course, Zambia's Kenneth Kaunda wore these suits with a sense of pride. They seemed to be celebrating cutting the link with tie-obsessed Britain. Perhaps not surprising, then, that some Kenyans have criticised this strict dress code, one describing it as a hangover of a colonial mentality.
The always impeccably dressed Will Ross there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Matt Hewitt. The producer was Carl Josephs. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.